Serving New York State and Southern Ontario, you're listening to WDCX FM Buffalo, WDCX HD1 Buffalo, and WDCZ AM Buffalo. WDCX AM Rochester and WDCX HD1 Rochester.
Welcome to Neil Boron Live. Real talk that gets to the heart of the matter and music that inspires. NBL is the place for information, motivation, and encouragement. So drop the mask, pick up the phone, and get ready to join the conversation at 1-800-684-2848 or 883-5000. And now, here's Neil Boron. Live.
Welcome to our Tuesday edition of NBL. My name's Neil, and that's the Zach Man. Some of you recall we did a four-part series on sexual abuse allegations that arose out of a Christian summer camp setting here in Western New York. It was powerful. It was necessary to talk about. And in the heels of it, we had the privilege of meeting a woman named Kimberly Norris. She and her husband, Gregory Love, of the Love and Norris Law Foundation in Houston, Texas, are the founders of an organization called Ministry Safe that has been used to help train over 2 million people in how to spot grooming behaviors, how to prevent child sexual abuse, equipping churches and other ministries to stamp out the child sexual abuse of children in their midst. And it needs to happen because it's everywhere. The bottom line is wherever kids gather, predators will show up, and whether it's a local boys or girls club or a sports team or a church or a Christian summer camp, predators will be present eventually because the wolves come where the sheep are grazing. And we're going to get a chance to dig in a little deeper today with Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, literally a worldwide expert on this, and making herself available to us this week to talk about some pretty deep stuff. I hope you'll be with us. If you missed any of yesterday, we're going to eventually post all of this to our audio vault at WDCXradio.com. But today we're going to talk about how all this starts at home, talking with kids about sexual predators. And by the way, stranger danger, not so much. The reason I'm saying that is because it isn't usually strangers that are abusing kids. It's people that are well known to the children. So we're going to talk about why stranger danger shouldn't be the, you know, the linchpin that you're hanging on in terms of protecting your own children. It's important, perhaps, but we'll talk about why stranger danger is not enough, and we'll talk about some of the free training that's actually available for parents right now because this is National Child Abuse Protection Prevention Month, and that's why we wanted to talk about this in the first place. We'll talk about some common grooming behaviors, how to spot them, what to do if you recognize them, how to prevent child sexual abuse, all part of the sexual abuse awareness training provided by Ministry Safe. You know, what do grooming behaviors look like? What about reporting requirements? If you discover that something's going on that is shocking to you but is officially happening, what do you do to report it? What are you required to do? If someone, maybe what if a neighbor child comes to you and tells you that something's been happening in their life, their uncle or someone else has been touching them inappropriately, what do you do in that case? Well, we're going to talk about all of those kinds of things on NBL today. And we also are going to open the phone lines with Kimberly Norris and spend some time chatting with her. So be ready for that. I'll give you the ground rules on what we'll be looking for in terms of your phone calls. Obviously, she's not going to be giving legal advice on the air, but we can talk with some pretty important material and share at least generalities of how these things need to be approached and addressed, and talk about how you can equip yourself to protect your children in any environment. So I hope that you'll be a part of it with us on NBL. And by the way, if you know someone with kids, maybe it's your son, your daughter, your niece, your nephew, call them and tell them to listen in to our conversation today with Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe and the law firm Love and Norris. But Lord, bless our conversation. Guide us through it. Lead us in a way that brings you glory. Lord, we want to protect the children that you have entrusted to us, those precious little ones. Help us to know what our role should be in standing for truth and righteousness and caring enough to arm ourselves and work towards the prevention of child abuse in our midst. And if it happens, God, what to do about it in a way that is courageous and brings you glory. Lord, we want to be about your plan and purpose. So lead us, we pray, in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. When we come back, Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe joins us on a Tuesday edition of NBL.
Darkness is nothing more than the absence of light. Get your batteries recharged weekday afternoons right here on NBL.
Yeah, and thanks for being with us. This is not an easy topic to talk about, but we chose National Child Abuse Prevention Month to be the month where we would do this, and coordinated the time with Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, and she was gracious to provide us with the opportunity to do this during this week, and we jumped at the opportunity. I just want to mention that she's a sexual abuse trial attorney and has been for years, has like three decades of experience representing victims of abuse, serving as a consulting and testifying expert in abuse cases, providing crisis management and allegation response counsel to child-serving organizations of all sizes, an acknowledged authority in screening practices. She's actually helped to train over 2 million ministry staff members and volunteers since 2005. After decades of litigating sexual abuse cases and providing legal counsel to ministries, she partnered with Dallas Theological Seminary to create the very first seminary course in existence exclusively addressing the risk of child sexual abuse in ministry contexts. She works with dozens and dozens of organizations. I have several pages of information and references here, but major names: New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Gateway Seminary, Bob Jones University, Dallas Baptist University, Liberty University, and the list goes on and on and on and on. So the point is, she has tremendous experience and insight and wisdom, and she's been gracious to join us this week to talk about really essentially their five-part safety system, which includes sexual abuse awareness training, skillful screening processes, tailored policies and procedures, appropriate criminal background checks, which are different from background checks, and also effective monitoring and oversight in this whole issue of protecting children in ministry contexts and otherwise. And Kimberly, welcome back to NBL. How are you doing?
Doing well. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so thank you again. Here we are, you know, second day of the week. You're going to be with us tomorrow. We'll be maybe wrapping up anything we still need to cover about sexual abuse awareness training. And I think we're also going to talk about, you know, an effective safety system. How do you get that established in a ministry environment? So, and then Thursday's going to be a lot of Q&A. We may do some of that today. We'll see how it goes. But today we want to talk about sexual abuse awareness training. But I kind of want to give you an opportunity first to maybe mention the parent training that's available free this month, literally, because it's National Child Abuse Prevention Month. And anything else you want to say before we start digging in today to the whole issue of sexual abuse awareness and training?
Sure. So we filmed parent training. We've done it actually several times now, but the most current iteration is me speaking to parents directly. Mm-hmm. Talking to parents about sexual abuse, sexual abusers, how to best protect your own children, you know, arming yourself and your child with good information. And kind of the guiding principle is preparation, not paranoia. You know, educating ourselves. If you don't know, find out, find mm-hmm. good resources, opt for honesty. And I think probably as much as the most important principle for parent training, in my opinion, is start early.
How early?
So even a two-year-old, small children can learn the basics. A two-year-old can learn and understand your body is your own, mm-hmm. and that other child's body is his own or her own. I mean, like a three-year-old can understand specific sexual parts, and I think it's really important to use the real names rather than pet names or referring to them as something else. You know, a four-year-old can understand physical affection is your decision. You get to decide with whom you are physically affectionate. Nobody makes that decision for you. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets the right to assume physical interaction with you, and that includes family members. The child gets to decide with whom he or she has physical affection or physical interaction. And I think even a five-year-old can understand respect for his or her body and respect for other people's bodies. But what I see regularly, and maybe particularly in ministry context, is parents waiting until their child is entering puberty, essentially. And in my opinion, preteen is too late. Basically, if you wait, it's too late mm-hmm. because you're... Your children are going to get this information from somewhere. and they should be getting it from us, their parents, because there's a line of communication open really early in order to have conversations. So in our home, there was no topic that was off limits, and I committed to honesty, obviously in an age-appropriate way, with my child. But it's super important to teach about sexuality at a young age, in my opinion. Again, we don't want to overwhelm a child with detail, but use real-life terms, use books, use examples. Pets are a good example. So back in the day, we had really prolific cats. He made a great object lesson for my daughter. So parent training is our effort to put information in before parents to help them start the conversation, to help them have appropriate protections in place for their own kids. And this iteration of it has been really fun for me because the back end of the training is a very frank conversation between me and my adult daughter, is now a second-year law student at Duke University, talking through with her what she experienced, what, you know, hearing the same principles from her perspective. And honestly, one of the best takeaways from that very frank conversation, which was unrehearsed, by the way, that was the first take, and that's what parents will see.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best takeaways, in my opinion, was her speaking to, what would you say to the parent who says, I don't want to make my child fearful, or I don't want to take away my child's innocence. I want them to remain in that innocent state. And she speaks to that very directly, and I think she did a really good job of doing so. So I really encourage your parents to take advantage of this opportunity to access the training at ministrysafe.com/April. It's free. Send it to anyone.
Yeah. So parents don't, I mean, write this down, by the way. If you know a young couple that lives next door to you that raising kids that could benefit, write down ministrysafe.com/April, and it will take you right to the page where they can observe the free parent training from none other than the leading expert in the U.S. on these kind of things, Kimberly Norris. So, yeah, it's absolutely free. And by the way, if you forget the name Ministry Safe and a couple days from now you say, oh, I want to get that done before the end of April, just go to our Facebook page, WDCX Radio on Facebook. We have it pinned right near the top. So if you click on it, it will actually take you right to the parent training. But for any resources, any information about anything we're discussing this week, go to ministrysafe.com. All one word, ministrysafe.com. Boy, I got a lot of thoughts to share. Let me just say right off the bat, maybe somebody's listening, kind of rolling their eyes like, well, come on, really? You know, sexual abuse in church ministry settings and whatever. And you just made a comment a minute ago about how if you wait, it's going to be too late. Kids are going to see. I was 8 years old, Kimberly, when a friend of mine between Sunday school and church, that little 15-minute gap, said to me, hey, Sunday school's over before church starts. You want to come to my car and see something? I was like, well, yeah, sure. So we ran outside the building. Probably weren't supposed to be outside, but, you know, felt kind of fun. Okay, I kept thinking he was going to show me a baseball mitt. I clearly remember I thought he must have got a new baseball mitt. And he opens the back of the car and pulls out a magazine that belonged to his older brother. And it was the first time I viewed pornography in my life. Mm-hmm. It happened in a hyper-fundamental Bible-believing Baptist church parking lot between Sunday school and church. That's where I first viewed pornography. So the idea that your kids are not going to be exposed to things or that there are not predators out there is just false. One in every three women, you told us, have been sexually abused, inappropriately touched or whatever before the age of 18, and it's like one in five boys. And if those numbers are even anywhere near accurate, that means one-third of every person attending a church and one-third of every woman attending a church knows just exactly what we're talking about here because they were victims. One in every five boys, more or less, are victims. And so it's all around us. And then, you know, if you could comment just briefly, we're not trying to scare people or sensationalize, but I made a comment at the open of today's show. You know, look, where sheep feed, wolves will be found. The reason is they like eating sheep. And predators will find children wherever they gather, and children gather in churches. So just generally, before we dig in here, help us understand the importance of realizing this is a problem. in schools and in our communities, but also in the church?
Yeah, so the church, unfortunately, is uniquely vulnerable to the risk of child sexual abuse in ministry context for a lot of different reasons. As you said, the wolves are going to gravitate to where the sheep are available. We know that preferential offender who prefers a child as a sexual partner is the significant danger to the church and Christian ministries because they are single-minded in seeking out access to kids. I mean, one of the largest studies that has occurred to date looking at convicted male offenders, those who actually went to jail for molesting kids, found that the convicted male offender in this very large study who preferred boys as sexual partners had an average of 150 victims prior to criminal prosecution. The convicted sexual male offender who preferred girls as sexual partners was sexually abusing girls had an average of 52 victims prior to criminal prosecution.
Wow.
So the church tends to be really isolated from really good factual information about recidivism, about how the risk might arise. You know, we tend to think if it's happening, certainly it's happening, we think, but it's happening out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's happening in some other socioeconomic or some other part of town or some other spiritual paradigm. Surely it's not happening within our congregations. And the reality is the statistics that we just ran through, they don't skip any paradigm, and they certainly don't skip church context or Christian ministry context. So we got to get more skilled. We have to get more informed about how this risk might manifest and why it is so prolific in Christ-based environments.
I remember seeing, I don't know if it was a mom or a preschool teacher or somebody tell me, and maybe a group of people I was with, I don't remember, you know, we teach our kids about stranger danger. We want them to know that, you know, you should never get in a car with somebody you don't know or go home with someone who promises that they're going to take you to your mom or dad. Or, you know, and by the way, I think that's really wise to teach your kids that kind of stuff. But you made a comment mm-hmm. the other day that really it was eye-opening because if that's the only kind of preventative measure you're providing your children, you're missing the boat. Because is it true that the vast majority of people who sexually molest children are not strangers to the children?
Yeah, so stranger danger is a bit of a misnomer in the sense that 90% of children who are sexually abused are sexually abused by someone they know and trust. It is not a stranger. So it's someone inside the proverbial fence. So basic stranger danger protocols, I'm okay with them, but that's 5% of offenses.
Oh, wow.
The great weight majority of offenses are not happening at the hands of strangers. And we got to understand that, you know, the danger is inside the fence rather than outside the fence. So we're not just watching for someone who's running down the hall in a ski mask with a kid under each arm in the children's wing.
Mm-hmm.
We have to better understand offender characteristics, what the type of behaviors that offenders participate in. And one of the behaviors that they participate in, almost without exception, preferential offenders who are targeting our churches, who have an age range and gender of preference. If there's a preferential offender in a ministry, a camp, a church, a missional organization, a Christian school, they are there for the purpose of accessing kids within their age and gender of preference. And they're going to groom children for sexual interaction. We've talked about that before. We'll talk about it again. Mm-hmm. It's a process. But equally important, and a concept that the church must get a hold of, is this: molesters groom the gatekeepers.
All right, stop, wait, hang on. I want everybody to catch what you just said. They're not only grooming the children to trust them, to perhaps lure them to a place where they can have alone time with them. You said they're grooming the gatekeepers? What does that mean?
Molesters groom the gatekeepers. So anybody through whom the molester has to go to gain access to a kid is going to be groomed as a gatekeeper. So the primary gatekeepers that come to mind are parents. But certainly in ministry context, ministry leaders supervisors, staff members are going to be groomed as gatekeepers. You know, coworkers, fellow volunteers are going to be groomed as gatekeepers. The molester is going to expend significant effort to have those who are around him think that he is a helpful, trustworthy, responsible guy or gal. We know there are female offenders as well, but he's going to appear to be a helpful, trustworthy, responsible person. And in Christ-based environments, that means he's going to have a great testimony. He's going to sound like you and me in terms of the spiritual paradigm. He's going to seem respectable. And this is, I've yet to encounter in 31 years of law practice in this realm, I've yet to encounter a church case or a ministry case where the gatekeepers were not groomed.
Say that one more time, because that was really powerful.
I've never encountered in 31 years of law practice, I have yet to encounter a circumstance where a molester was in a ministry context and he did not groom the gatekeepers to think that he or she was a helpful, trustworthy, responsible person. And this is why when these situations hit the news or when people first become aware of an allegation or allegations, plural, what you almost always hear is, I'm so shocked. He was the nicest guy. She was such a great gal. You almost never hear, I knew that guy was a slime ball.
Yeah.
And that's intentional.
Unreal. We got to take a break, but let's do this. I want to point out that we may take some live phone calls beginning probably near the top of the hour, 3 o'clock-ish, and see how long that goes. We've got so much to talk about here, but we do want to give you an opportunity to join the conversation. Let me also mention that on Thursday this week, we're going to focus most of the conversation on Q&A kind of things, questions that you have. I want to just say on Kimberly's behalf, she's an accomplished attorney and is an expert in the law as it relates to these things, but she won't be answering any legal questions because it's unfair for her to try to give you legal advice when she doesn't know all the nuances and details of a particular situation you may be involved in. So she won't be giving specific legal advice and isn't able to. However, she may, in a more general sense, be able to answer questions you have about how to effectively, you know, institute a training session in your church, how to get the pastor and leadership on board with why this is important, whatever questions may come to mind along those lines. And then secondarily, you know, how do we as parents and ministry leaders spot the perpetrator when, in fact, they look like the rest of us? And we've been groomed to believe they are like the rest of us. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions that are going to come to mind that you may want to ask, and we'll be opening the phone lines probably around 3 o'clock this afternoon, so get ready for that. But we got to take a break here. We're going to be back in a moment. Remember, there is parent training, an entire hour-long parent training video that's available to you free of charge just by going to ministrysafe.com/April. We also have it pinned on our WDCX Radio Facebook page if you want to find it there. But either way, we encourage you to connect with the folks at ministrysafe.com/April for the parent training. There's other information available there as well. We'll get to some of that. But when we come back, we're going to dig in a little deeper. How do you recognize grooming behaviors? How do you prevent child sexual abuse? What does sexual abuse awareness training entail? What's that even look like? Maybe you're not familiar. We're going to talk about it when MBL returns.
What song is playing right now? Find out. Just look at the WDCX app on your smartphone for all the details.
Yeah, there's a lot of information available there, and we'd encourage you to check it out. Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, our guest. You can learn more about them by going to ministrysafe.com. But 3 decades of experience as an attorney dealing with sexual abuse cases. Her husband, Gregory Love, is the other part of the law firm Love and Norris, and they are the creators of Ministry Safe, and largely because they began to see patterns emerging in all of the sexual abuse cases they were dealing with. And from conversations they've had and things they've learned from convicted sex offenders who've been interviewed after the fact, how did you do what you did? How did you carry it out? Which I think, Kimberly, you might be able to confirm is a condition for people ever getting parole. They have to be willing to talk about what they did. But you guys have learned an awful lot about the patterns, and I think that was sort of the genesis of Ministry Safe. You realized you could begin to teach people what predators do and how to spot behaviors to help arm them preventatively for the kind of things that they or their children might encounter. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just the whole idea of cluing the church in, and I'm speaking of the church, capital C, any Christian ministry, that molesters groom the gatekeepers, that molesters groom kids for sexual interaction. At the kind of the point being, and happy to walk you through that process briefly.
Sure.
The whole point being, if the grooming process is visible, so it's supervisable, and it is subject to sight. Therefore, if it's viewable, then it's preventable. Especially if parents have some idea what they're looking at or what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing in ministry context. When ministry staff members, when ministry professionals understand the grooming process of the abuser, when they are conversant with common grooming behaviors, they are much better equipped to prevent sexual abuse in ministry programs because they have a different category for the behavior.
Well, you know, I mentioned yesterday that I think I've been in about 10 different churches in my lifetime because my parents jumped a few churches and I've lived in different places and I went away to school and I worked in Washington, D.C. for a while. So of the 10 churches, I could think of at least 9 where something serious happened that was either covered up or dealt with in a fairly appropriate way. But either way, it happened. I'm thinking of a situation where a teenage boy abused a younger boy in the congregation sexually. I'm thinking of a situation where a pastor abused a teenage girl. A youth worker used his phone to film a girl changing in a room, left his phone on recording in a room where a girl was about to change. He got caught and arrested, thank God. A youth pastor who was showing pornography to a young boy and began to get sexually involved with him till that was discovered and later covered by the church, meaning it was never dealt with. The boy who was injured in that situation wants nothing to do with God, wants nothing to do with church. Just tragic situation. And one other one that I'm going to mention real quick, and by the way, I could go on for another half an hour telling you stories about things I encountered. But I remember one time being asked to go to an overnight at a friend's house, and of course, everybody loves to do that. I was about maybe 13 or 14 years old. He had an older brother, and he had a younger sister. Well, the older brother also invited a friend over, so we had this large car. It was a Lincoln Continental, and it was packed with mom and dad and my friend and his older brother and his younger sister and this other guy that his older brother invited to come over to the house. Well, he was a real popular guy. He was new to the church. Nobody really knew him, but he was cool. He had a leather jacket. You know, he was the man. So that guy had this young girl sit on his lap on the way to the house. What I found out later, because I later asked, well, whatever happened to that guy? I haven't seen him in months. It was discovered the girl told her parents when they got home. But in the back seat of the car, about 4 feet away from where I was sitting, he was putting his hand up her skirt. And so my point is, let's not be naive. This stuff happens everywhere, and sometimes literally almost right under the noses of parents or youth workers or staff members at churches. And again, this is not to sensationalize, but Kimberly, the work that you're doing is so important. And I thank you for it. But I don't know if you want to comment. I mean, I'm one guy, but I could tell a dozen stories right off the top of my head of things that I know that happened in church settings, that some of which may have been preventable if proper training had been in place.
Yeah, I mean, at a minimum, a lot of child sexual abuse that's occurring in ministry contexts is preventable with proper training and policies in place. There will always be child sexual abuse issues that occur in the child's core world that the church does not have control over.
Mm-hmm.
But the church does need to respond properly when that child communicates about what happened in their core world and make an appropriate report to law enforcement in that setting. So there's certainly, it's not just all dire news. There are certainly preventable or preventative protocols that can be put in place that go a long way toward solving the issue, at least as it relates to actual ministry programs. You know, where parents are concerned, the good news is we are largely in control, just in large part, of where our child spends time. And we have control over the types of activities that they're involved in. So we have more ability to safeguard and protect our own children than anybody else on the planet has. because they are under our authority for the period of time that they're children.
Wow. So important. And let me mention, you know, obviously Kimberly did say that there's some parent training available free of charge on the Ministry Safe website all this month. It's National Child Abuse Prevention Month. So avail yourselves of it, Mom and Dad. Get it. Understand some of the things. It won't be a full, you know, training manual by any stretch of the imagination, but it will get you thinking in the right direction. And the training that you provide is incredibly cost-effective for ministries and stuff, so we can talk about that in a minute. This isn't an infomercial. We're just thrilled to have the leading expert on this in the U.S. available to us this entire week on NBL. And I will say we will hopefully take a few of your questions at the top of the hour, so be thinking about that, and we'll give you an opportunity to get on board in just a few minutes. But Kimberly, real quick, as far as sexual abuse awareness training, we won't go into great detail here, but somebody might think, well, you know, I listened to Kimberly Norris on NBL with Neil, and so I'm now geared up and I'm prepared. That's not exactly what you mean by sexual abuse awareness training, but it is the foundation of everything that you guys teach through the organization Ministry Safe. Give us the brief overview. We'll take a break, then we'll come back and dig into some of the nuts and bolts. But what is sexual abuse awareness training officially?
Yeah, sure. So in awareness training, we look at the common misconceptions, which include stranger danger, which include too heavy a reliance on criminal background checks, includes the idea that I'd be able to spot an abuser when in reality abusers look like you and me. Mm-hmm. We talk about abuser characteristics. We talk about the reality that many offenders and all preferential offenders have an age and gender of preference. We talk about the grooming process of the offender, and we walk through it with specific examples that come from ministry context, come from ministry cases. And here's the way that an offender will gain access to children. Here's how he will select a specific child. Here's which children are more likely to be targeted than not. Here's how he introduces nudity and sexual touch, which always includes barrier testing and erosion, figuring out what kids will accept now, and then through repeated exposure, pushing back that barrier in terms of touch, in terms of subject matters, in terms of content that the child is exposed to. We address how offenders keep the child silent after sexual touch has occurred. We talk about the reality that offenders groom kids, yes, but they also groom the gatekeepers. And we actually have an offender clip from an offender talking about, you know, the best way to fool people is to help them. Ask what they want, ask what they need. Do they need any help doing anything? Talking about grooming the gatekeepers to cause them to believe he's a helpful, trustworthy, responsible guy. We talk about what to do if a child reports abuse. So if you happen to be that trusted adult that a child comes to within your ministry program and tells about what's happening someplace else, what you do, what you don't do. We address methods to reduce the risk of child sexual abuse. We talk about short-term and long-term impacts on children, so you know, things you might actually see in the short term that would be an outcome, and in the long term, we spend a pretty good portion of the training talking about peer-to-peer sexual abuse, which constitutes 1 out of 3 reported cases today. 1 out of 3 reported cases are children who are sexually abusing other children. When I say children, anyone over the age of 18. And then we talk about reporting requirements, because there are mandatory reporting requirements in every state in the United States and in Canada. So reporting child abuse and neglect isn't just a good idea. It's the law everywhere.
Well, I got to believe that some of you that are listening in the U.S. and in Canada today know the importance of what we're talking about, because you yourself have lived through some of the things that are being described here. At the same time, obviously, we're not going to be able to go into detail on all of the issues that Kimberly just mentioned, because they're included in hours worth of training that Ministry Safe does. And then, you know, obviously, they have levels of training. There's sort of the introductory stuff, sexual abuse awareness training as an introduction, and then it moves up the ranks from there. But ultimately, some of these concepts and ideas have actually been incorporated into seminary courses now. Thank God, where potential ministry leaders are being trained what to do when this kind of thing happens in your church and how to avoid it and how to set up accountability and reporting requirements and other things. So I don't know what questions might be swirling in your mind, but I want you to be thinking about them. And remember, Kimberly's not able to provide any direct legal counsel to you, but if you have a general question along these lines or just a comment, I mean, maybe you're just thanking God that we're actually talking about this and you want to jump on board and make some kind of a comment about how this has been a benefit to you, feel free. But your questions and comments will be welcome somewhere around 3 o'clock. We'll be taking some of your phone calls. And we'll open the phone lines then. No sense trying to get through. I've got them locked out right now. So there's a lot more to come, and we'll be back with Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe. 30-plus years as a sexual abuse trial attorney representing victims of abuse, serving as a consulting and testifying expert in abuse cases, and much of her wisdom and the wisdom of her husband, Gregory Love, contained in the Ministry Safe program, which can help you and your congregation and your organization be prepared to recognize and, Lord willing, prevent child sexual abuse in your situation. And how do we protect our kids? We want to talk about all of this. So we'll get to the phone calls in just a bit, and we'll be back with Kimberly Norris.
Maybe you should just quit trying harder. I have news for you. It doesn't work.
Well, Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe is our guest, and if you want any information at all about the work that they do to prepare churches and ministries and families to prevent child sexual abuse, be aware of it, and then to know what to do if, in fact, it happens, all of that information is available at ministrysafe.com, and I urge you to go there and get the info that you need. By the way, she and her husband, Gregory Love, work with hundreds of clients across the country, including organizations such as the Christian Camp and Conference Association, American Camp Association, National Association of Church Business Administrators, POLS, P-O-L-S, Principals of Large Schools, National Council for Adoption, AWANA International, the U.S. Olympic Committee, and so many other organizations. And she's gracious enough to spend time with us here on NBL. I want to get right to this question of grooming, because you brought it up several times. I think we'll probably touch on it again a little bit each of the 4 days, because it's such a pivotal aspect of this. But just one question I have, how can you really know? Like you said, if you just line up an abuser next to a group of people that aren't abusing kids, they may not look any different at all. Their behavior may be similar in the sense that they're being helpful and kind and loving, and they're enjoyable to be around, and they have this, quote, great testimony. So, like, in the end, how do you actually know, other than discernment from the Holy Spirit? But obviously, paying attention to grooming behaviors, watching answers they respond to on an application to be involved in kids' ministry, maybe that all matters. But can you be a little more helpful along those lines? Like, how does this work? Do we have Kimberly with us? Did we lose her somewhere? I don't know if we lost Kimberly. Zach, why don't you try to reconnect with her, if you don't mind? And in the meantime, re-ask that question as soon as we can reestablish contact with her. But, she is here. All right. I wonder if I hit the wrong button. That's my bad. So I don't know. Did you hear the question that I just raised, Kimberly?
I did.
Okay. Don't know what happened, but we got you back. Okay. So, we don't need to belabor this, but I'm just curious, because somebody may be thinking, okay, well, the grooming behaviors are similar to behaviors of people who aren't grooming kids.
Sure. So some basics. You cannot identify a sexual abuser by their appearance or what they look like. You have to identify them behaviorally.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to understand the grooming process. Let's talk about that briefly. First of all, molesters tend to gravitate toward career or volunteer opportunities related to children. So I'm at this point speaking to both parents and ministries. They are going to groom the gatekeepers. They're typically pretty good at figuring out what kids want, and then they're giving them that stuff. They're good at figuring out what kids want or need, and then they're giving it to them. So you will see one-to-one giving, giving stuff, giving privileges, giving access to things that otherwise the child wouldn't have access to. So they tend to be, superficially at least, popular with kids because they're giving them stuff, they're giving them access to things. So one takeaway for parents here is if your child has stuff or is doing things that you haven't paid for, you haven't authorized, and they're vague about where it's coming from, start asking questions. Because this is a very common grooming behavior to gain access through figuring out what kids want or need and giving them access to that.
Mm-hmm.
They also tend to be skilled at age-specific communication, so they will have commonly peer-like interaction with kids rather than staying in the role or the position of an adult. They tend to interact in a more peer-like context. The child who is more likely to be targeted is a child who's unconnected or on the fringe or in need in some form. It can be, we call it the edge of the herd syndrome, but these are the kids who are more likely to be targeted, I think in part because they're less likely to be believed because they're on the fringe. It can be a child who's looking for someone to follow or trust. So they're looking for a caring adult to step into a role that might be missing that component in their home life. It can be a child from a broken family or a single parent home. So it's important that churches recognize this is a very common MO for abusers. If you're providing services to single parents, single moms, or single dads, that a very common MO for male preferential offenders is to target single moms in order to gain access to their kids, sadly. It can be a child who's already involved in alcohol or interested in alcohol or drugs. And this is a real tool in the belt of the offender because it wraps secrecy into the equation. Because very few kids are going to come home and tell mom or dad about drinking alcohol or drinking beer or smoking marijuana, et cetera, et cetera. It has the added benefit of it lowers inhibitions. Sometimes the child doesn't know what did or didn't happen in those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're encountering circumstances where it appears that your child has or may have been exposed to alcohol or drug use in any form, or you find paraphernalia, or you find evidence of that kind of use, that would be potentially problematic in terms of child sexual abuse risk. The molester is going to introduce nudity and sexual touch in some form, and that's typically going to involve figuring out what we call barrier testing and erosion, figuring out what a child will accept now, and then pushing back what that child will accept by repeated exposure. So another common grooming behavior that parents could be watching for, as well as ministry staff members, is touchy with kids. Pushing physical boundaries. The molesters tend to be touchy with kids. I think it's important that you have bright line expressions for your own children and for, in the ministry context, for children in the ministry program, what is appropriate physical interaction between a staff member or volunteer and a kid who's involved in the program. So I'm always asked, what are your bright lines, Kim? And some of my bright lines that I communicate to ministries and that I enforced in my own child's life. I'm not a big fan of wrestling, not a big fan of tickling with younger kids, roughhousing, pantsing, cup checks. If you don't know what that is, ask anyone in student ministry. Lap sitting. I don't think children should be sitting on the lap of unrelated adults or other older children. Lap children are literally infants. Anybody over that age shouldn't be sitting in the lap of an unrelated adult. I'm not a big fan of piggyback rides for the same reason. There's too much body closure. Not a big fan of a child riding, straddling the neck of another adult or much older child. So those are some of the boundaries that I put in place. But I think where parents are concerned, part of this issue is teaching your child that he or she gets to choose with whom he or she is physically affectionate. That no adult, some little kids don't know they have the right to say no to an adult who's in a position of authority over them.
Mm-hmm.
So authorizing our kids to say no, particularly as it relates to touch is super important. As well, in terms of the touch paradigm, I think it's very important for ministries to have a real bright line expression of that. This is okay, and this is not. And the benefit to the ministry is, you know, if somebody steps over that bright line related to touch, they are more likely to hear about it if they have communicated very clearly, this is okay, and this is not. And in a ministry context, I tell my ministry personnel, I'm okay with one grace pass from somebody who steps over your bright line. And then you've got to be willing to enforce your bright lines or start cutting people free who are not seemingly capable of sticking to what you've expressed is appropriate in your ministry. One of the other behaviors that I see that is visible that parents will encounter too, that's a common grooming behavior, is breaking the rules and then justifying and rationalizing rule breaking. So it happens in families, it happens in ministries. So an abuser will step over your bright line or step over the boundary that you put in place for your own child and then tell you why it's okay that it happened. So I know you didn't want little Jimmy to go to the water park with us. Here's why it's okay that I took him. The classic example that I've been giving since I encountered it years ago was in camp context, where a camp counselor, staff member, was found in the wrong place at the wrong time with the same kid three times, and it was day five of camp. So he was someplace he wasn't supposed to be at a time he wasn't supposed to be there when the child was supposed to be doing something else. Same kid three times, and it was day five of camp. When the camp director called him in, what the camp counselor said to him was this: I have this kid in my cabin who's completely shut down, not participating in cabin time stuff, really doesn't seem to be making friends or connections. And so I've been meeting with him alone to figure out what's going on. And good news, today he told me about a horrific situation that's happening back home. His parents are getting divorced. That's not great. But he feels like he's in the middle. And I think that that was kind of a breakthrough. And as well, we'll be able to get some resources into his hands or through his church, his home church, when he goes back home. So when I train live, I ask my live audiences, is it possible that everything I just said from the mouth of that camp counselor is completely straight up? Is that possible? And the reality is, yes, that's possible. But it's likewise possible that this is a preferential offender who's come to an environment with a real superficial screening process prior to his onboarding, came to a place where children within his age and gender of preference are gathered for him, and he has carved out a fringy kid, and he's spending time with him one-to-one, unsupervised, repeatedly, in order to groom that child for inappropriate sexual touch. At a bare minimum, it's a great example of breaking the rules and then justifying and rationalizing rule breaking. And the reality is, parents, you cannot always easily distinguish the predator from the idiot. Yeah. And that's true for churches as well. You cannot always distinguish the predator from the idiot. And it's another reason why, in ministry context and child-serving programs, we've got to have bright line expressions in place. This is okay. This is not. I'm okay with one grace pass. And after that, we got to start cutting the idiots free.
So the bottom line is, when they start crossing those lines or violating other boundaries, such as, you know, our Christian organization, our camp has a no-touch policy. When that's repeatedly violated, when people are discovered in places where they shouldn't be, at times they shouldn't be, on repeated occasions, in my mind, that's grounds for immediate dismissal. I don't know what else the organization should do beyond that, but how many slaps on the wrist can you give before you become liable for putting a child in a very dangerous situation, right? I mean,
right. When somebody is participating in what are known common grooming behaviors repeatedly, which also includes repeated time alone with the same child. So molesters will carve a kid out from the group to spend time with that child in contexts that are not subject to supervision. So kind of the takeaway for parents is, in child-serving organizations, start asking questions, and there are a list of questions that are included as a resource in that parent training link at the end. Here are the questions you should be asking and the places that your child spends time to properly protect your child. But just in terms of your child's interaction with any significantly older child or adult, you want to be aware that you want to go really slowly to give time alone, or to be okay with time alone between your child and an unrelated adult or a much older child. Because you cannot go really slowly to give that kind of access to your kid. Because what molesters are looking for is trusted time alone with your child. Not subject to supervision, not something that you can watch. Because they've set it up that way. They're spending time alone with the same child in context that cannot be supervised.
Wow. All right. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. We'll take a look at our weather forecast and continue the conversation in just a moment. But we're going to take some phone calls here. We will do a Q&A thing on Thursday. We'll have much more time for Q&A. But I want to ask you, if you've been listening and you are dying to jump in with a question, again, Kimberly will not be providing you with direct legal advice, but she can speak in broader terms related to the material that's covered in the course, things perhaps she's seen in ministry contexts in the past due to her experience. But if you have a question, I'm opening the phone lines right here, and our toll-free number is 800-684-2848 or 883-5000. So you've been listening. Don't hesitate. We're not going to belabor this. We've got some time for some open call kind of questions with Kimberly Norris. And if you've been dying to ask a question or get some follow-up on something she said previously, feel free to give us a call, because now's the time. 800-684-2848 or 883-5000. You're listening to NBL on WDCX. And by the way, if you want more information about MinistrySafe, go to MinistrySafe.com. MinistrySafe.com. The number here, 800-684-2848 or 883-5000. And cathedrals
made of stone. There's stuff you usually don't talk about in the lobby at church, which is why we offer Neil Boron Live.
Yeah, this is one of those topics that probably not being widely discussed in church lobbies. I think largely because we're human and we don't want to believe that this kind of stuff could ever happen in a church, but a church is populated by humans, and humans do things to hurt each other from time to time. Christians also struggle with sin, and being prepared, knowing how to react if something does happen, how to get educated and install preventative measures so it doesn't happen, are all things we want to be talking about this week. And if you've got any kind of a question or comment, feel free to change your name, use an alias if you want. We're not looking for you to reveal the names of churches or pastors or anything. But boy, we would sure love for you to ask any question that's on your heart or your mind. And again, Kimberly will not be providing specific legal counsel to anyone, but if you've got a question based on some of the things we've been discussing this week, feel free to join us. Maybe even a comment about some of the things you've seen in the past that, you know, that obviously might have turned out differently if any of this information had been known at the time. Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, our guest. She's recognized a leading expert as a sexual abuse trial attorney and somebody who helps to prepare and has literally trained more than 2 million individuals to recognize and spot and, by God's grace, prevent sexual abuse in church and ministry settings. I want to get to Sharon. We're going to go to hybrid two here, Zach, if you don't mind. Let me get to Sharon in Springville, south of Buffalo, southeast or southwest, 800-684-2848, 883-5000 if you want to join us. Sharon, welcome to NBL. You've got a question for Kimberly. What's up?
Thank you. I do. And just real quickly, this grandma was pretty shocked at what I had just heard with this unfortunate topic, that the 5% is really only from strangers. And my question is, and thank you for covering this topic, but my question is, I'm just wondering if the free resource, the training for parents for April, would non-Christian parents be comfortable with it, or is there a strong Christian bent to it?
That's a good question. Kimberly, what about that parent training? Would it be useful for somebody who doesn't attend a church or speak Christianese?
Yeah, it's pretty much ecumenical. It's being promoted this month on both our secular side and the ministry side. So Ministry Safe is what we've been discussing. The secular resources with the same types of stuff is called Abuse Prevention Systems. So it would be useful on either side. A non-believing parent would not be offended by the content.
Okay.
The first one you mentioned. Okay, great. Okay, yep. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, and again, during the month of April, that parent training, it's an hour-long video that includes training from Kimberly. And then, Kimberly, you have a conversation, I think you said, at the end with your daughter, who's a student at Duke, about some of these things. But there's a lot to be learned for parents, and that's free this month.
All right. Yep, it's a free resource, and we address all that what you can do as a parent to protect your child, what you should watch for, what type of behaviors you should be sensitive to, what you should ask your own children periodically, what you should do if your child tells you this happened to me. So it's all there. So it's a great resource for parents to up their learning curve on how to better protect their own kids.
You know, it's one of the questions, actually, that I had. You just kind of touched real near it. So let's go to that for a second, because if you address some of that in your video, I think it might be helpful to know the answer to it. Obviously, there are reporting requirements for people like pastors, counselors, teachers. I think all pretty much show up on the list, no matter what state or maybe even province you're from. So there are, you know, they're legally required to report if they believe that some kind of abuse, like we were describing here, sexual abuse, has occurred. What about when a child comes to a parent and gives some kind of information that leads the parent to believe that something may have happened to their child? Is the parent required to report? I mean, they might be talking about, you know, their best friend's father, where they had a sleepover recently, or older brother or something. I can imagine that parents would be like, oh, my goodness, if I say something, I'm endangering our relationship with that family or whatever. And while on the one hand, it shouldn't matter, on the other hand, I think it does. So what would you say to a parent?
So in every state, there are mandatory and permissive reporters. And the trend, and this is the case in Washington currently, as well as 20-some-odd other states, the trend is every adult is a mandatory reporter, and that includes parents. We're beginning to see, as we referenced earlier, that kind of the legacy of the Penn State scandal is criminal prosecution for failure to report, and that includes ministry contexts, and that includes parents who fail to report something that's communicated to them by their child or another child. So mandatory reporting requirements are trending toward the place where every adult is a mandatory reporter, where you are immediately to report any actual allegation or reasonable suspicion of child abuse or neglect. In most states, there's no clergy privilege. And, you know, speaking to what you referenced, what the objection that many people have to making the report is, what if I'm wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What if I suspect this and it's not actually the case, or what if this child is telling me something that's just not 100% accurate? Well, let's take the last one first. False allegations are rare. They are less than 5% in study after study after study. So typically, if a child says that it happened, you can pretty much take it to the bank that it actually occurred, pretty much regardless of the age of the child. The false allegations are rare. The flip side of that is adults who encounter some behavior that causes them to suspect that a child has been sexually abused, who says, well, what if I'm wrong about that? I'll speak to that briefly. Our state legislatures, by putting this really wide funnel at the top, by making state by state every adult a mandatory reporter, and saying that adults have to immediately report any allegation or reasonable suspicion of abuse or neglect, by creating that really wide aperture, what the state legislatures are saying is they're taking the decision kind of out of our hands in some sense. The state legislature is taking the position that the safety and welfare and the compelling state interest of protecting this child outweighs the potential inconvenience to this adult or much older child. So it's a mandatory report with this really wide aperture. Trust me, the adult, when the report is made in compliance with state law, the adult gets all kinds of due process. There's a significant process that the adult is has access to in terms of criminal law enforcement and investigative processes. When a report isn't made, i.e. the law is violated, the child gets no due process. So our state legislatures have determined for us, essentially, that the safety and welfare of the children in our state outweighs the potential inconvenience on this other side. Now, as it relates to family situations, I think you got to go back to every time a adult or family member says, gosh, if I report that, that's really going to ruin Christmas. Or every time a ministry staff member says it's really going to have a negative impact on our reputation or public perception or our brand if I make that report, here's the reality. That completely negates the reality of offender recidivism. The child before you is almost never the only victim. So failure to report not only violates the law in almost every state, it not only reporting is not just a good idea, it's the law in every state. So failure to report leaves that child unprotected. It negates the possible accountability that would possibly result in criminal prosecution and conviction. And it negates the potential accountability that would limit future victims of the same abuser.
Wow.
And no adult should feel comfortable being in the position of determining, you know what, the rampant recidivism of preferential offenders is not important to me. It's not important to me how many future victims will fall prey to this individual. My personal comfort or lack thereof is more important than this child's welfare. No adult should be comfortable with that position.
Huge. All right, we've got to take another quick break. We'll be back with Kimberly Norris in a moment. We maybe may have time to get to other calls here. 800-684-2848 or 883-5000. Not sure how quickly we'll be able to get to all of them, but if you have a burning desire to jump on board with a question or comment, right now is the time to call. And we will have some more Q&A with Kimberly Norris on Thursday's edition of NBL.
Sometimes feel unloved? The truth is, there's never been a moment that you were not loved by God.
Well, thank God for that. His love is unconditional. I want to get back to the conversation here with Kimberly Norris. And we've got the phone lines open. If there's time to get to more than just a few calls, we will. We've got a couple of off-air questions. And Kimberly, let me try to give you the synopsis here. One from somebody who was abused in a Christian ministry setting, but who shared an interesting quote with me that I want to get to here real quick. It said, the gospel is not hurt by revealing the truth. It's hurt by concealing it. And I think what they're getting at here, if I could summarize, it's, don't we do more damage by not dealing with this forthrightly and truthfully, as opposed to trying to say, well, we really better not talk about these kind of things openly because it could hurt the gospel. It could hurt, you know, the name of Jesus or the brand we're trying to portray for the image of our church, as if brands matter to God. But your thoughts about that real quick?
Sure. My experience is Jesus can hold his own.
Amen.
I agree that, you know, taking the position that somehow, some way, we're going to protect the organization or protect the ministry in preference to protecting those who the ministry is supposed to serve it's real short-sighted in so many different ways. It leads to damage. It re-victimizes the abuse survivor.
Right.
It ultimately, in my experience, comes back around. These things don't go away. They just come back around later on. And then it has the unequivocal appearance for the ministry or the organization of cover-up. And sometimes that's not just an appearance, it's reality. There was an overt attempt to cover up what happened mm-hmm. or keep the toothpaste in the tube. And that's never appropriate. And frankly, not only is it harmful to the abuse survivor or the child who's been victimized or the adult who comes back and says, this happened to me in this ministry program, not only is it harmful or damaging to that person, it is ultimately harmful to the ministry itself or the organization itself, because when the organization starts making decisions that are meant to protect the organization rather than those that the ministry is supposed to serve, then that means all priorities are skewed.
Gotcha. All right, Matt, let's get to your phone call in Buffalo. Matt, you have a question for Kimberly Norris. Go ahead.
I do. So, Kimberly, I'm going to give you this scenario, and you tell me what you think would be the best way to handle it. So let's say that in a ministry context, someone disclosed to me that there was abuse, or the church found out that someone was abused, and they didn't handle it the right way. They just sort of quietly ushered the abuser out, and, maybe a couple years later to find out that this individual moved on and abused somewhere else, or potentially was back in another position with access to children. Given the recidivism rates and what I've heard you say over the last 2 days, what would you say that someone should do? I mean, let's say it's 5, 10 years even. I mean, people might look and go, why are you digging up old stuff? But at the same time, someone might think, well, you might call it digging up old stuff, but I'm scared, or the person's scared, that this person might be reoffending and causing much harm. I mean, what would you say about a scenario like that?
Yeah, generally speaking, what would the responsibility be if Matt's correct? Let's say this information is learned by an individual. Do you have a responsibility to let others down the road know what happened? Yeah.
I don't feel comfortable speaking to a specific context, but I will say that generally, if an allegation was reportable when it occurred, then my advice to ministries and individuals, so far as that goes, is that it's reportable now. And that's particularly true. Historical allegations should be reported, and that's particularly true if the sexual abuse occurred on that ministry's watch. So it was that ministry's staff member or volunteer, somebody wearing that ministry's name tag, was the alleged perpetrator in that circumstance. And so I advise all my ministry clients, if it was reportable then, it's reportable now. Now, the reality is, in many circumstances, if the victim himself or herself is unwilling to testify or file a police report or participate in criminal prosecution, the reality is prosecutors aren't going to take cases where they can't get evidence of the bad act. They're not going to prosecute a crime if the victim himself or herself is unwilling to give testimony and participate in the prosecution process, because there are too many other cases that need prosecutorial attention and prosecutorial resources. But my advice to any abuse survivor who calls my law firm, regardless of their age and the passage of time, is make the report, because it puts that individual's name in the system. And whether the criminal statute of limitation has passed or not, that means the time period within which criminal prosecution could ensue. Whether that time period has ticked out or not, making the report creates accountability from the standpoint that if anybody else comes forward and makes a report and their case is actionable, it takes it out of the realm of a he said, or a he said, she said, because there's been a prior report filed. So my advice to actual minister or abuse survivors when they phone me is make the report, regardless of how long it's been. That advice is replicated to ministries at least who want my legal advice about that specific issue. If it was reportable then, it's reportable now. Anything short of that, in my opinion, has an appearance of cover-up.
Gotcha. Matt, thanks for the question. We had a whole bunch of stuff here that we're not going to be able to get to, including a comment from an individual who was abused in a school setting, another question from somebody abused in the home. Bottom line is it's happening everywhere. We're going to continue our conversation. And Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, gracious to be with us today. More information is available, of course, at ministrysafe.com.
Need some good news? The wounds of Jesus paid our ransom.
Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, sexual abuse trial attorney, over 30 years of experience in dealing with this kind of stuff. She and her husband, Gregory Love, are from the law firm Love and Norris in Houston, Texas, but they're also the founders of Ministry Safe. And you mentioned there's a, sound like a corporate kind of more secular arm of the ministry of your organization as well that maybe deals with this stuff in a workplace setting or somewhere else. What was that part called?
It's Abuse Prevention System. So okay. Think any child-serving secular organization like youth sports, zoos. We've got youth-serving programs from professional sports teams, et cetera, et cetera.
Gotcha. Okay.
By the way, I can't let it pass, Neil. I'm from Fort Worth, not Houston.
Are you serious right now? Oh, wow. I feel terrible. I've been saying Houston the whole time. I'm trying to keep your fans away by sending them to Houston.
Houston is a great city, but Fort Worth is my home.
Okay, Fort Worth. I've been to Fort Worth. Zach, my son, who's the producer, went in one of the rodeos at Fort Worth, and he was about 6 years old and almost caught the tail of a calf chasing it around. So we got good memories of Fort Worth.
There you go.
All right. Well, okay, so from Fort Worth, my bad on that whole thing. But anyway, ministrysafe.com is where you can get more information about all of this. And, of course, the parent training materials are free this month. Don't hesitate to watch it. It'd be the best hour of your life spent, Mom and Dad, being able to equip yourselves for this kind of thing, which raises an interesting question. And I know it's one that you hope to talk about at some point, so let's bring it up now. What if your own child says that something happened at some point? What do parents do?
So there are some basics that parents should remember and be aware of. First of all, your child, if he or she is communicating an outcry to you, needs you to listen and respond calmly. So you need to be the grown-up. You need to be the parent in this equation. If you have a very emotional or angry or if you have any kind of really emotional response, you're likely to back that child up and he or she may not continue to communicate. You want to be sensitive to vague or partial disclosures. So one of the reasons why you need to have an open line of communication with each one of your children about sexual topics and about child sexual abuse issues is because the number one reason in study after study after study that kids don't tell is if I tell, no one's going to believe me. And commonly, the abuser, think about it, the abuser has groomed the gatekeepers. The abuser is typically someone that it's hard to believe that they would have participated in this behavior, at least in terms of how they've presented themselves. So the allegation is commonly difficult to believe about someone who's difficult to distrust. So be sensitive to vague or partial disclosures from your child because, again, the number one reason kids don't tell, if I tell, no one's going to believe me. Mm-hmm. Commonly, the abuser has told the child, if you tell, no one's going to believe you. They're going to believe me, not you, and I'm going to tell them that you're lying and you'll get in trouble for lying. And that reality yields vague or partial disclosures, like just a little piece of the story. So it's important to calmly listen and ask open-ended questions. You don't want to say anything that assumes something happened that was abusive. You don't want to put that thought in the child's head, but at the same time, open-ended questions, like what happened next? Is there something else you'd like to tell me? What your child needs to hear from you if he or she is telling you about sexual abuse is, I believe you, it's not your fault. That's big.
With a calm voice.
Open-ended question. Yeah. We don't want to ask shaming questions, and that seems kind of self-evident, but the ones that happen pretty regularly are things like, how long has this been happening? Why didn't you tell me sooner? Especially if the parent seems upset. Why didn't you tell me sooner? What were you wearing? That's my personal favorite. Why were you someplace you weren't supposed to be? Why were you out after curfew? Because we all know nothing good happens after midnight, right? Why were you doing something you weren't supposed to be doing? These are questions that will make your child feel as though he or she is responsible for their own abuse, which, of course, you do not want to reinforce any sense of shame or embarrassment in that circumstance. You want to report to authorities where your child communicates child sexual abuse to you, and authorities in this context is the police. And, you know, do what you can to have that child feel safe, cared for, believed. It's not your fault. And frankly, in many scenarios that involve intrafamiliar sexual abuse, so it's a step-sibling or a cousin or an uncle it is very, very, very important to prioritize your child's comfort and not everybody else's comfort. In other words, your child should not have to see his or her abuser next Thanksgiving because everyone assumes the whole family is going to get together. You should prioritize your child's comfort and welfare and sense of healthy protection in preference to any sort of family pressure or preference.
This stuff is so practical and so powerful, and I want to encourage any of you who are listening who are parents to do the parents' training. It's free this month, National Child Abuse Prevention Month, free from Kimberly Norris and Ministry Safe, and you just need to go to ministrysafe.com/April, and you'll find it right there on their website, ministrysafe.com/April. If you forget the name Ministry Safe, we've got it pinned on our Facebook page, WDCX Radio on Facebook, and click on it. We'll take you to the exact same place. You'll be able to watch the parent training that's free this month. And then, Kimberly, we've only got a couple minutes left here, but real quick, for those who may have just tuned in and they're not aware, you guys are the leading experts on this. You've trained over 2 million people in church and ministry settings to adequately deal with this. That means that still there's a lot of people that need to be trained, many churches that are not equipped, and this stuff is readily available. You've got resources. You've got what's necessary for people to take the abuse of children seriously and make it a priority in their Christian ministry or church context. So just talk about that real quick, because sexual abuse awareness training is available, information about your 5-part safety system, the whole thing. Just take a minute so people understand what they can avail themselves of literally through your website.
Yeah, so Ministry Safe was created to make appropriate resources, training, screening forms, training about how to screen appropriately for child sexual abuse risk, policies and procedures in all kinds of different child-serving contexts, tools for monitoring and oversight, a control panel that allows you to send training to staff members and volunteers, including, the foundational training, awareness training, but as well training ministry managerial staff members with skillful screening training, training your pinnacle ministry folk with Ministry Safe Institute, which is 16 and a half hours of material that forms the basis of the class that we teach at Dallas Theological Seminary, but it's reduced to capture in video form. So we have all kinds of resources, which not the least of which for ministries is Ministry Safe members have access to competent legal advice, and that's one of us, on an hour-by-hour basis at a reduced legal fee. I don't work for free. I like what I do, but not enough to work for free. But every ministry gets a reduced legal rate that's significantly lower than the secular rate. So our ministries have access to competent legal advice through people who have worked in this realm for over 3 decades. So all of this is in a self-help context at ministrysafe.com, and it's that way on purpose because I'm the daughter of a church planter, And we wanted, there are multi-mega churches that are utilizing these resources. One of my largest churches has 17 campuses with over 175,000 members. My heart beats fast for the littles, mm-hmm. the church plants, the little congregations. And the majority of churches in the United States and Canada are less than 100 members. So the purpose of this was to put it in a self-help context so people could avail themselves of state-of-the-art resources without having to spend the money that to have a lawyer come in and do it for you from beginning to end. Because our heart beats fast for those. You know, it's a travesty when a child is sexually abused in a context where, for instance, he or she was training for the Olympics or training in a youth sport context. When a child is sexually abused in a ministry context, that has even more significance in many contexts because the mission of the church is eternal. And we've got to do a better job of protecting kids and responding properly when a child comes to us with an allegation, whether it's from the outside in their core world or from the inside within our ministry.
Wow. Well, tomorrow here on NBL, we're going to wrap up anything else that there is to say about sexual abuse awareness and the training provided by Ministry Safe. And there are a number of things we didn't yet cover. Also, we're going to talk, Lord willing, about implementing an effective safety system in ministry environments. How do you get started with this? How do you get this stuff in place if you're one of the littles and this has never, ever been dealt with? But you realize it's necessary. You need a plan. You thought that criminal background checks were going to be a major upgrade, and then you found out that 95% of the people who show up in a criminal background check really have never been arrested, so they have no criminal backgrounds. In other words, predators aren't being caught by criminal background checks because there's no criminal background to report. But they're predators, and they're hanging out in your midst. So what do you do about all that? And we'll talk in detail again tomorrow about that with Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe. Get the details at ministrysafe.com. Can't thank you enough for all the time you've given us this week. Tomorrow, looking forward to it. And then Thursday, we'll do more Q&A, take some phone calls from our listeners. But Kimberly, thank you. God bless you, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Yep, you're welcome. God bless.